So good afternoon again, ladies and gentlemen. And I'd like to thank you very much for the effort that you put into that session of sitting practice meditation. What we're going to be talking about this afternoon is what's called crazy wisdom lineage, which is that for 2,500 years, people have put a lot of effort and energy and wisdom into the sitting practice of meditation in exactly the same way as you practiced it today. Because people have been doing this, because human beings have been doing this, have been putting a lot of effort and energy and wisdom into this for 2,500 years, sitting practice of meditation becomes very powerful and, in fact, somewhat magical. But what's important to understand is that the sitting practice and all the other practices that we engage in our community have nothing to do with quick fix. That somehow you become a Buddhist, you start to practice, and you're never going to have any problems again for the rest of your life. It doesn't work like that. There's no sudden relief from confusion. But as we said, it has to do with coming down to earth. Coming down to earth and learning how to appreciate this world exactly as it is. That we could appreciate our mind and this world exactly as it is. And the problem that we have is, which we discover more and more, we discover this problem more and more the more that we sit, is that we are always trying to change this world. We're always trying to change our mind. We're always trying to find a more pleasurable state. And that very effort in terms of trying to find a more pleasurable state is what continues to create harm both to ourselves and to others. We're always looking for further entertainment. We're always trying to create some sort of potential fantasy world that we think will make us feel more comfortable, more safe, more secure, more relaxed. We always are wanting to create some sort of potential dream world. And because we're always involved in that effort to create this fantasy world, there's constant struggle. There's constant pain. And therefore, we find ourselves involved in complaint after complaint. We complain to everyone about everything, all over the place. And nevertheless, still, there is no way out. We have to relate with our mind. We have to relate with this world exactly as it is. In this very moment, it couldn't be otherwise. In this very moment, our mind, our world could not be otherwise. So crazy wisdom has to do with learning how to relate with our world as it is. Crazy wisdom has to do with wisdom gone wild. It's wild wisdom. But actually, if you look at the Tibetan, the way that it's actually talked about is, we say crazy wisdom because that's the way the English language works. But actually in Tibetan, it's wisdom crazy. Because wisdom has to come first. Otherwise, you're just crazy. That doesn't do anybody any good. So it's wisdom crazy. Wisdom comes before crazy. And wisdom begins on the spot, right now, with what's called nowness. Nowness. This very moment on the spot. Being awake this very moment on the spot. There's sudden glimpse of goodness. There's little surprise that occurs right in the midst of the most ordinary activities of our life. That we might be walking down the street, doing what we're doing, feeling depressed, feeling excited, feeling whatever we're feeling. Our heads are down, we're talking to ourselves, and suddenly, for no reason whatsoever, there's some kind of surprise. Could be anything. Could be something in the phenomenal world, sight, sound, taste, touch, smell. Could be just thoughts or just a little moment of space. And for no reason whatsoever, it seems, just for a moment, our head and shoulders come up, and there's like moment of openness, which we call basic goodness. nowness. Sometimes when the Vidyata would talk about nowness, he'd snap his fingers or gasp. There's sort of shock or surprise, like, and all your interpretations and your judgments and your opinions, the way that we normally look at the world, dissolve just for a moment. And that's the wisdom in Crazy Wisdom. The wisdom lies in the nowness. We might have our complaints about the past, our hopes and fears about the future, but wisdom comes from nowness. And the way, one of the ways that the nowness is transmitted from generation to generation in our lineage is through stories, sometimes stories about great teachers. So I thought perhaps I could tell you just a few. For example, there's a story of Luhipa. Luhipa is one of the people who was called one of the 84 Mahasiddhas at the beginning of the Vajrayana, the indestructible path, which took place in India. He was one of the 84 primary crazy wisdom people, 84 primary men and women who realized or attained crazy wisdom. And Luhipa started out in his life as a prince. He was very ambitious. And so he decided to leave his palace, leave his kingdom. And he went off into the mountains and found himself a cave, and he practiced meditation for 12 years. And at the end of the 12 years, he decided that he had attained enlightenment. So he left the cave, left his meditation cushion, and wandered down into a nearby village. And he thought that he would find a good meal, have a drink after all these years. And so he goes into a tavern. And it just so happens that the owner of that tavern is a woman, as we would say, a dakini, crazy wisdom person. And she sees this guy walking in and she says, "Look at him," to one of the people who work with her, "look at him. He's been up in the mountains for all these years and he thinks he's attained enlightenment. But he still has a very high opinion of himself. He's still holding on to the fact that he was born as a prince. He's somewhat arrogant." So they take his order, and he orders lasagna, let's say. I don't know if they actually had that in India, but so I have to admit I kind of made that up. He orders lasagna. And the way that she has the kitchen prepare it is, it looks beautiful. It's got the noodles and the tomatoes and the cheese. But in the middle of the dish, where you can't see it, consists of what they call fish entrails. Fish bones, fish guts. Really yucky stuff, right, as far as we're concerned. So they serve it to him and say, "Sir, we hope you enjoy your dinner." And he takes a big bite and, moment of nowness, surprise. He expected the world to be one way and it turned out to be another, which happens to us all the time. And he's so upset that he picks up the dish and he throws it against the wall. And the dakini, the woman, the owner of the tavern, says to him, "I thought you'd attained enlightenment. Why are you having so much trouble? You must have some opinion about how your food is supposed to taste." And because he has practiced for 12 years, he's understood something. He realizes that he's in the presence of a person who has understood something that he doesn't understand. So he bows down to her, and he asks her if she would be his teacher. And so she says yes, and she gives him some formal practices to do, because there are always formal practices to do. But she also gives him some post-meditation, what we call post-meditation instructions, how to deal with the rest of his life, which is that for his next 12 years of retreat, he's only allowed to eat one dish, one type of food, which has to do, of course, it's fish guts, fish entrail. So the story then goes that he practices for 12 years, and it says in the text that after 12 years, he had completely dissolved all of his interpretations and opinions and the judgments and ideas of good and bad, and he truly became enlightened. And he became famous teacher, one of the 84 Mahasiddhas, who was affectionately known by his students as Luhipa, which translated means old fish guts. So that's one story about Nannus. Another one, which is a very famous story in our particular lineage, has to do with a man who was a great scholar, renowned to be the greatest scholar in India, and his name was Naropa. And he was the primary teacher. He was the most revered and regarded as the most knowledgeable teacher at what was called Nalanda University, where all of the, you had to have really high college board scores and so forth to go there. And he was such a great teacher that people came from all over India just to hear him speak. And nevertheless, one day he's studying his books about philosophy, about Buddhist philosophy, in the library. And when suddenly he notices, or he feels almost, that there's something behind him, a shadow. And he feels a bit uneasy. And he turns around, and there's an old woman, who in our tradition is known as the old hag. The old hag. And she's described as being quite old, first of all. Her face is very shriveled up. Her eyes are bloodshot. I mean, she's not what we would usually call a pretty sight. You know, you wouldn't find her on the cover of Vogue magazine, right? And her nose is all scrunched up, and there's tears coming out of her eyes as though she has allergies, and her ears are long and lumpy. And she makes chewing or sucking noises with her mouth, like... And to top it all off, she has a hunchback, and she's supporting herself on a walking stick. And so Naropa's like, oh, who are you? How did you get in here? How did you get into my library? And she said, well, Naropa, actually, I've just come to ask you a question. I see you're studying great Buddhist texts, Buddhist philosophy, and my question to you, Naropa, is simply this. Do you understand the words, or do you understand the sense? In other words, do you understand the words, do you intellectually understand the teaching, or do you understand the real meaning behind the teaching? In other words, basically, are you enlightened? And Naropa said, well, I understand the words. And the old hag got very happy, and she starts dancing around the library, sort of like a little Irish jig. And then Naropa, who's a nice person, thinking to make her even happier, says, and I understand the sense too. And she gets very angry. She gets quite pissed off. In fact, she takes her stick and she throws it down and she begins to cry. And he says, what have I done to offend you? You were so happy when I said I understood the words, but then when I said I understood the sense, you got very upset, got very angry. And she said, well, Naropa, the reason I got happy when you said that you understood the words was because you were telling the truth. You do have good intellectual understanding of the teachings. But when you said you understood the sense, you lied. Because as far as I can see, Naropa, you don't know anything. Which is a big moment of nowness for Naropa, like, oh, because he realizes that this old hag is telling the truth. He hasn't really incorporated, he hasn't been able to identify with the teachings completely. And so he asks her, well, who does? How can I learn? And she tells him about her brother, whose name is Tilopa, and there's all sorts of wonderful stories about Naropa's journey to meet Tilopa, during which he has many moments of surprise and shock and nowness, but we'll save those for another time. And then the third story is about a young Tibetan boy who lived somewhat around the time of Naropa, and his name is Marpa. And Marpa grew up in a little village in Tibet. And it seems that Marpa caused all sorts of problems for his family because he had very bad temper. In fact, Trungpa Rinpoche used to refer to Marpa as Tibetan redneck. Tibetan redneck. He was a rough guy. And he was always getting into fights and beating up the other children in the neighborhood. And as a result, his parents were very embarrassed, very freaked out. They didn't really know what to do with him. So at some point they call him in and say, "Well, I know, look, you know, I think you're going to have to leave. You're causing us tremendous problems. And we think that perhaps it would be a good idea if you would learn, go and learn to practice meditation. And so what we're willing to do is to give you your entire inheritance right now so that you'll have a way to do this. But you have to leave." And he says, "Well, that might be a good idea. What I think I would like to do is if I'm going to learn to practice meditation, I would like to learn from the best teachers." And in those days, at that particular time, the best teachers were said to be in India. So he sells, he gets his inheritance, his land, his yaks, whatever. He sells it all and he collects quite a good bit of gold dust. Because in those days, gold dust was regarded as the most precious substance, the most precious gift that you could offer a teacher. And the idea was to offer the teacher something precious. It didn't have to be money. It didn't have to be gold dust. But the idea was to offer the teacher something that you normally would try to hold on to or keep for yourself. So he collects all this gold dust, and then he sets off on his journey across the Himalaya Mountains, which is obviously very long and difficult. He's a young boy, and they say that it took Marpa 3 years to walk from Tibet to Nepal. It's right next to India. And when he gets to Nepal, he starts asking people, "Where can I find the best teacher?" And the sort of most reliable people that he meets all say, "Well, the best teacher is Naropa, but the only problem is nobody knows where he is. He used to be a teacher at Nalanda, a professor, but he met this old hag and something happened. And he set off into the jungle and he's said to be somewhere in the forest, somewhere in the jungle with his students, but nobody knows exactly where that is." So Marpa decides he's looking for the best. So he sets off on this journey. And on his way, he takes some odd jobs, you know, maybe works at McDonald's, whatever, and collects more gold dust, because he wants to have so much to offer the teacher, because he really wants to receive his teachings. He wants to learn how to realize his basic goodness. He wants to learn to be a warrior, a Buddha. And then finally, seemingly by accident, he stumbles onto the place where Naropa lives. And he meets some of Naropa's students and they say, "Well, you can see him, we can arrange for an interview, but you'll have to wait." So he sits down to wait to meet the teacher and he begins to get agitated. He begins to get nervous because, "Well, what if this guy is a fake? You know, what if he takes all my gold dust and I don't learn anything? What if he's not the real thing?" So he thinks maybe the safe thing to do is maybe he'll take some of the gold dust and he'll stash it. He'll put it in his pocket. He puts some, let's say, in his shoes. Maybe he puts a little bit in his briefcase or his knapsack or his backpack or whatever. He still keeps a very decent amount out, just in case he is the real thing. But he puts a good bit of it away. Takes a deep breath. Now he feels better about the whole thing. And suddenly, the teacher appears. And he's a shocking person. He's not at all what Marpa expected to find. He's not sitting like someone who looks like he's sitting on a cloud in a peaceful, blissful state, but he's a wild man. He's got these bright, protruding eyes, wild eyes. He's got long, matted hair. And he looks kind of scary. And so Marpa nervously presents himself to Naropa, same Naropa we talked about in the previous story. And he bows and says, I've been looking for you for a very long time. Please teach me. And as a gesture of how much I would like to study with you, please, I'd like to present you with this gold dust. So Naropa takes the gold dust, and he looks at it and he says, well, this doesn't look like very much. Don't you have more than this? And somehow the teacher knows that the student is holding back. So that's kind of shocking. So he reaches into his knapsack and he takes another portion of gold dust, but he's still nervous, so he still holds back a little. And he offers the new pile of gold dust to the teacher. And at this point, Naropa gets very angry. He says, I worked very hard to receive these teachings about warriorship. I spent 12 long years with my teacher, Talopa, and he put me through a lot. If you want to receive these teachings, you have to give everything. Again, not necessarily meaning money or gold dust, literally, but you have to give whatever you would hold back for yourself. And so, at this point, Marba's convinced that this person's for real. And he reaches and he takes all of his gold dust and he offers it to the teacher. And the teacher holds this precious gold dust that he's been collecting for years in his hands, and then all of a sudden, in an instant, he throws it away. Scatters Marpa's gold dust into the jungle. And he says, that's a very famous saying in our tradition, what need have I of gold? This whole world is gold to me. What need have I of gold? This whole world is gold to me. And I think probably all of you must know Gesar Mukpo, at least somewhat. And when Gesar was 7 years old, actually, I was supposed to be the person to tutor him in the teachings of Buddhism and Shambhala. And our very first lesson that we ever had in Lake Louise, Canada, he was 7 years old, I told him the story that I just told you, pretty much exactly the way that, you know, that we just did just now. And I remember at age seven, he sat up in his chair after he'd never heard the story before, and he sat up in his chair and he said, Mr. Friedman, could I please explain the story to you? I'd never really done that much with Gesar before, so I was interested to hear what he said. He said, the teacher, Naropa, had realized that everything in life is precious. The teacher's heart was beautiful, so everywhere he looked, he saw a beautiful or sacred world. And then he said, the real meaning of the story, 7 years old, the real meaning of the story is that the teacher's heart was golden. So everywhere he looked, he saw a golden world. It's a moment of nowness. That's what happens in the moment of nowness. That's why we call it wisdom. Because in that moment, if you look out, everywhere you look, you see a golden world. So in order to understand crazy wisdom, wisdom crazy, we have to make friends with the nowness, with that sudden gasp. That little moment when all of our constructed worlds, our worlds of make-believe, fall apart. Why do we have to make friends with the nowness? Because we've been asleep. We have to wake up. And all those stories about nowness are just to give you some notion of what that surprise, that startle, that moment of sharp, vivid awareness, which we call basic goodness or awake, what that's like. As you know, in Shambhala, we call it basic goodness. In the Buddhist tradition, it has many names. It could be called Buddha nature, Mahamudra, Mahati. And it's said in our tradition that that little moment happens something like 60 times in the blink of an eye. 60 times in the blink of an eye. And nevertheless, even though it's happening all the time in our lives, we try very hard to avoid that moment. we're constantly engaged in activity of how can we defend ourselves against that experience of nowness? How can we protect ourselves so that we don't have to experience that direct contact with our world? And we do that. We protect ourselves, we defend ourselves, not just once, but over and over, again and again. And because we're doing that all the time, we feel quite self-conscious. Because we're always watching ourselves. And that's very painful. Because we're always preoccupied, we're always busy, we're always preoccupied with me. How can I get what I want? What's in it for me? When we do that, when we're preoccupied with meanness, we tend to forget about the world outside. And as we said, what we do instead is we make up a world and we live in it. We make up a make-believe world and we live in it and pretend that it's real, which is very painful because it's not real. So we're constantly involved in trying to create something and maintain something which is falling apart 60 times in the blink of an eye, and yet we're trying to keep it going all the time. And it's very painful because the whole thing isn't real. So it's said that the best way to dissolve this painful self-consciousness is to relate more fully with the world outside of ourselves, very simply with sight, sound, taste, touch, smell, and others. Nowness, crazy wisdom, has to do with relating with the world outside. When you relate fully with the world outside will always provide you with very direct message. And because it does, therefore, we can begin to learn. Unless we're dreaming. Because when we're dreaming, we're not relating with the world outside. If we're completely in touch with the world outside of ourselves, then that self-consciousness and pain begins to dissolve. So it's very important to say that in the crazy wisdom lineage, meditation practice is always accompanied. Meditation practice is always accompanied by interaction with the world outside. So then why meditate? Why not just relate with the world outside? And the reason is because meditation is our training ground, so that we can work with our daily lives, so that we can work with the world outside without dreaming. Remember, we said there has to be contact, but that contact has to be direct and real. But what we find and what we begin to see as we sit and sit and sit and sit and sit and sit and sit is that we're pretending. We're pretending. No matter how good or how nice we might be, at some level we know that we're pretending. And a meditation practice is the practice of not pretending. It's the practice of nowness. We might see ourselves involved in our thoughts of the past or the future. They're all simply dreams. They're all simply thinking. And because there's so much space built into the meditation and practice itself, we have the opportunity to see our confusion clearly. We see the way that we cover up our basic goodness 60 times in the blink of an eye. See the ways that we pretend. And as we practice more and more, that world of pretense and hypocrisy begins to fall apart. And then when we begin to relate with the world outside, they see all kinds of gaps, all sorts of spaces that we can actually jump into situations and be of benefit both to ourselves and to others. People are usually frightened of jumping into situations. I mean, I always think of Trungpa Rinpoche when we say things like this, because he was a person who grew up in basically a medieval Middle Ages country, no electricity, no internet, no television, no entertainment. And then really jumped into the situation, which is that he escaped from the Chinese communists, found his way to England, and then came to North America and basically jumped right into the middle of our lives. People are frightened of jumping into situations because it's regarded as a dangerous thing to do. It's taking a chance. Usually what we would like to do when something comes up is we would like to think about it. We would like to sleep on it. We would like to analyze it. How should we handle that situation? And maybe finally we come to some sort of conclusion. Of course, by then the situation may have changed. And maybe we do something, or maybe we act. But generally in our lives we hold back quite a lot. Now, I'm not saying that we should go off running around doing all sorts of impulsive stuff. But the question is, how can we help this world? Crazy wisdom, it said, takes 1/60th of a second. And in that 1/60th of a second, you could be a Buddha on the spot. If we're not pretending. We could be a Buddha, you could be a Buddha on the spot. You could be kind, accurate, precise, and compassionate on the spot. That there's sudden flash of nowness, and you see, you actually see with your eyes how to relate, how to click into the situation. Because you're completely open, you know what to do. You know how to work with what's in front of you, which only comes from immense training in nowness, sitting practice of meditation, which brings immense basic sanity and immense confidence and dignity into our lives. So, crazy wisdom, nowness. So, do you have any questions? Julia?
If we have to, when we're thinking of as everything being golden, then how can you have like ambition and drive? Like maybe you don't have to, but then how would you deal with moving forward in life?
Right, that's a very good question. Well, it doesn't really help to think of things as golden. Remember, that's just thinking. That's simply thinking. So what we're not recommending is to take, for example, the things that I said in this talk and then try to think that that's how it is. What we're talking about is waking up. When you wake up, when you see that golden world, even if it's just for an instant, then you see where to go and what to do. It doesn't have to be based on a strategy. Doesn't mean you can't make plans. But the idea would be, as best as possible, to make those plans from the perspective out of the experience of nowness. So you don't have to come up with any particular thoughts or any particular beliefs or any particular plan that has to be foolproof and you know is going to work. The whole practice here through the practice of sitting is to wake up further and further. Usually what we're doing in our lives is we're walking around with our heads down, thinking to ourselves about how to achieve whatever it is we think we want to achieve. And as a result, we bounce around like a ping pong ball. When you wake up, your head and shoulders come up and your gaze goes out and you actually see exactly where to go, including what to do next. So I suppose you could say that it's not exactly ambition, but it definitely has to do with moving forward. And in fact, it's the only way that you can move forward. You have to see it. Otherwise, you might make a so-called decision about what to do next based on your analysis and your ambition, but you always end up second-guessing yourself. You always end up having doubts because it simply was a product to whatever extent of your discursive thought. When your direction, it was very interesting, for example, to watch the Vidyadhara. He had many projects. I mean, they're all around us. Shambhala Training, Naropa Institute, Nova Scotia. He always was moving forward. He was always creating more. But I think that we can safely say that these projects, so to speak, were based on his insight rather than simply his ambition. It didn't ever seem to have anything to do with what's in it for me. And therefore, his projects succeeded because they were based on wisdom. Now, to some people, his projects seem quite crazy. For example, all of us coming to Nova Scotia might seem crazy, but they were wisdom crazy.
Wisdom crazy. Yeah.
Okay. We had someone else.
I recently saw Chögyam Trungpa's talk on the fourth moment, which I sort of understood as a view of the present without bias from like the past or the future, the way I sort of personally understood it, just sort of which I would think of as nowness. And so I'm wondering how that would relate to the nowness that we're talking about today, like if it's the sort of that golden view of the world is sort of closer to the fourth moment or further away.
I think they're identical. But fourth moment would be another name for nowness. There's many names for nowness in the Buddhist tradition, which is so that you'll have maybe 84,000 ways to click into the whole thing. As we said, Buddha nature, Maha Mudra, Mahati, basic goodness, fourth moment. Sometimes he talked about it as the great switcheroo. Because, you know, it sort of turns your world upside down just for a moment, in our experience. Now, a person like the Vidyadhara, as far as we could tell, lives in that world of nowness all the time. So it has to do, I don't know if it has to do so much with, without bias is a really good way to say it, except that sometimes that could be interpreted as taking an attitude of being without bias, which isn't exactly, might be a good start, but it's not exactly the same thing. And in that moment of surprise, before you can think, before you can prepare, before you can establish any ground. That's why I do that, like that kind of thing. Then at that moment, the world is always fresh and new, which is truly moment without bias. So yes, it's exactly the same thing. That's great. Talia?
Could you maybe give us an example of, like, insight? Like, how do you know if you just think you had insight or if you actually did?
Yeah. Well, in some sense, there's always no guarantees. And that's part of what that's all about. I suppose the more you practice, you might begin to have some sense of it, but it's never like you never can get it down to a formula. An example could be anything. Anything.
Your life?
Sure, pardon me? Absolutely, it happens to you all the time.
Oh, and you just don't know?
Usually we either miss it, or maybe we don't miss it, but we don't trust it. Because it happens very fast. We're talking about something 60th of a second, right? So it happens very quickly in that moment of openness. But remember what we said is that what we're in the habit of doing over and over again and again is covering that up. You know, sort of like when Marpa wanted to stash the gold and put it away and hide everything. We do that all the time. We actually try to protect our wisdom, which is what keeps our wisdom from growing. We have to actually expose our wisdom to the world outside. But Dahlia, it could be the simplest thing. It could be, you know, the example I've used a lot is that people might be in a fight with each other. You know, you're in some sort of struggle, let's say with one of your friends or your family. And suddenly, for no reason whatsoever, you might experience just a moment of softness. For no reason. You know, you just look at them and maybe they look kind of cute or maybe they look really sad and you see that they feel hurt and you soften. You know, your own opinionatedness or anger or judgments just drop away for a moment and the thought might just come up very simply that you could just drop it. But then we don't. See, it's just something that simple. Or you might see that, you know, someone you go to school with, they pass by and you could see that maybe they could use a friend for a second. And you could just go up and say, how you doing? What's going on? but then we feel shy, so we don't do it. So there's never any guarantees. You can't really know that you're doing the right thing ahead of time. That's part of it. Otherwise, that's like some sort of contract that you've made with the world that what you do is going to work out. And compassion, you always has to do with always being willing to take a chance. What do we say? Probably at Sun Camp you've heard, not afraid to be a fool. Yeah. It's like that. But somehow or other, when you make that seemingly even foolish, perhaps, or awkward gesture that's based on the moment of nowness, what you do turns into act of grace. In other words, what you do becomes graceful. That awkward gesture becomes act of warriorship. You have to take a chance.
Does it ever happen on a subconscious level that you, like, how can you decipher your
moments of insight?
Yeah. That you don't know are happening. From the ones that are moments of insight from the things that your brain's making up.
Right. Okay. And something like this is the moments of true insight, they're happening all the time. Okay. Like I said, you might not see it, or you might see it for a moment, but then you get nervous, or you don't trust it, or even forget it, even saw it. But traditionally, the way that you can see it is that those thoughts don't have any baggage. And you begin to learn what that feels like. Meaning, there's no quality of fixation attached to that thought. It's often said that that kind of thought arises like the sun rising in a cloudless sky. Whereas a lot of those other kinds of thoughts, however you describe them, I forget what you said, the more confused thoughts, have a lot of baggage attached to them. What you want, who you are, who they are, what could happen to you, are they going to like you, are they not going to like you, are they going to reject you, am I going to win, am I going to lose, basically what's in it for me. So that's basically how you tell the difference.
Okay.
Right. And that again comes about, being able to see that difference comes about through the practice of sitting meditation, fundamentally.
If nowness is happening to you all the time, then how can you know when you experience it, like, profoundly? Like, if it's happening to you every second, then how do you know if you've really... Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, again, it has a lot to do with sitting practice, because what happens in sitting practice, you might sit down and think, okay, now I'm going to be sitting, and now I'm going to get to see what nowness is. But the first thing that happens is you begin to see all the ways in which you cover up nowness. Just all the tricks and the ways you dodge and duck and run and hide, and you're avoiding something. Then there might just be a little moment of light touch or humor, and then you experience, you begin to see the way you just close down, the way you shut down. So you can't, it's a very interesting thing, you can't make basic goodness happen. You can't make the nowness happen. On the other hand, it's happening, what you begin to see is that it's happening all the time. It pops up, you try to hold on to it, once you try to hold on to it, it's gone. That's what you begin to see through the sitting practice. And at some point, I think what happens is it's not like you make a conscious decision not to cover up, but it's somehow your basic sanity begins to see that this whole process of holding on is totally useless. And so it just begins to drop away. It doesn't really matter so much that you know that that's nowness or you know that it's not nowness. Yeah, that's still like trying to hedge your bets, you know what I mean? Like you could say, okay, that's nowness, I got it now. You know, like you might learn a new card game or something like that. It's not like that. It just starts to take over your whole being, your entire life, whatever you do. And it's a sudden process, because nowness is always sudden. But it's also, from the point of view of being a practitioner, it's very gradual. Happens a little bit at a time. And that glimpse of goodness, that, you know, when the teacher threw the gold into the jungle, it said that the student just for a moment, he had a glimpse of golden world nowness. But as he practiced with that teacher for the next 12 years, that glimpse expanded until it became his entire life. Then at that point, the moments of confusion became just very temporary.
So the reason you can't hold on to nowness is because it's now? You can't...
That's right. You got it. Anybody else? Well, I want to thank all of you for being here this afternoon. And welcome to the Crazy Wisdom Lineage.
You have been listening to Dharma Classes on Chronicles Radio, a production of the Chronicles of CTR. Thank you to Tim Hutchings for his work on audio recording and post-production sound editing. Support for Dharma Classes comes from our listening audience. To contribute, please visit chroniclesradio.com and click on Support This Work. Thank you for your support.